This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have two special guests that are going to talk about the Star Trek Encyclopedia, the newly revised Star Trek Encyclopedia. It's Michael and Denise Okuda. Am I saying that name right?
You are indeed.
Yes, okay. You are.
That's one of the biggest fears I have. I'm going to say the name wrong, and the author's going to hang up on me, you know?
No.
You know?
Got it right the first time.
You guys sound like really cool people, just talking to you. You know, you sound like you're really down-to-earth people. How did you get into the Star Trek universe?
We both got into Star Trek because we were fans, and it turned out the show needed something that we were able to do.
So which show did you start out on?
The first Star Trek I worked on was Star Trek IV. excuse me. I had taken the route of I sent a resume and a portfolio in following Star Trek II. Because I had some ideas how you might do graphics, and I figured I'd get brushed up, but that's okay. I figured it's worth trying. Imagine my surprise when I got a phone message from Ralph Winter, who was one of the producers of Star Trek III, saying, "Well, we're already staffed up in Star Trek III, but if we ever do a Star Trek IV, I'll give you a call." And I thought that was the nicest brush off I've ever gotten.
And you never expected to hear back from him.
2 years later, to my utter shock and, of course, delight, I got a phone call from Ralph saying, "Hey, we're doing Star Trek IV. You want to work on it?"
Oh, wow.
I had to think about that for about a quarter of a millisecond.
What Michael didn't tell you is that he was living in Hawaii at the time, and he knew no one in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles. So he sent a portfolio, and Ralph Winter was impressed enough to call him in Hawaii, and 2 years later, when Star Trek IV went into production, Michael was called back to work, and thereby hangs the tail.
That's really cool. The fact that they remembered you from 2 years ago is just astounding. You know, and nowadays with entertainment, if you don't make a splash right away, you're gone. You know.
Today's world is very, very different than it was back when Star Trek IV was being made. But Star Trek is a very tight community. It still is a tight community. And we've had the pleasure to meet with Ralph over the years through different projects we've been working on. And he's just a really nice guy and obviously was impressed with Michael's work.
Right, exactly. So what was your first day like on the set, Michael? I can't imagine how nervous you must have been.
Actually, I had a fair bit of experience in very low-budget television, commercials, and corporate graphics, community theater. And so my overall impression was that it really wasn't fundamentally different from any of those things, just on a bigger scale, a tighter schedule and bigger budget. And the folks at Paramount were all business, but they were also very welcoming. The first person I worked with on stage was with Neil Rodas, who was one of the art directors on Star Trek IV. And he gave me a bit of advice and said, "Hey, look, anybody can draw a cool spaceship. The challenge is not so much to draw a cool spaceship, but to draw something that solves the production's needs, that gives you that." Says, "Okay, this is the story we want to tell. This is how the director wants to tell the story. So what can you design and build on this, with the amount of time, with the amount of money, that fulfills the needs of what production needs? And if you take that approach, you're generally going to do you're generally doing good for the show."
Obviously, you must be a good artist to begin with.
Well, certainly I like to think so. But again, it's partly coming up with a cool design, but it's partly coming up with a cool design that solves the production's needs.
Right, exactly. You have to supply something that they're looking for.
Yes, for example, let's say there's a control panel that you have to know what the characters do with that control panel. You can't just say, here's how a real spaceship would be. You have to say, well, there has to be enough controls for the actor to do this, or there has to be provisions for that story point to happen. Or there has to be the physical ability to, for example, if the director wants to be able to pull out the panel to put a camera in, the panel's got to be designed to allow that. It doesn't matter how cool it is otherwise if you're obstructing the production. So it's a series of all these things that sound very mundane, but they're an integral part of the filmmaking process.
But it's fascinating to you. This is what you got into in college to do for the rest of your life. So this is interesting for you, nonetheless.
Oh, very, very much. It's always a series of overlapping, interconnected problems. What's the best solution for this particular moment, for this particular production, with these particular resources? And coming up with that is always a creative challenge, and 10 different people will come up with 10 different answers.
I'm looking at the color pictures in this book, is that they're just amazing. I mean, and the way you have the pictures of all the different characters is just so great. I mean, you can just, if you watch the show now, and I know there's a new channel on the air now that's showing some of the old reruns. It's called HNI. I don't know if you get it in California, but they're actually showing Voyager, and I don't know if they're showing Next Generation. I think they're showing Enterprise too, the one with Scott Bakula.
We know of HNI, and we know they're carrying the Star Trek, which is of course very cool. The new encyclopedia, we have more page count, but there's a lot more material in it. And one of the things we wanted is we wanted a lot more pictures, not just. We wanted a picture for every episode, and we wanted a picture for a lot of characters and spaceships and things. So Marion Cordry and Holly Imus at CBS Consumer Products, those poor people, they spent literally months pulling pictures.
We've done a revision of the Star Trek Encyclopedia. The first one was published in 1994, and the last supplement, the last one that was published, was 1999. So we hadn't done an update in quite a while.
Right.
And originally they wanted us to maybe thin the entries to make it one volume, and we very much wanted to resist doing that. So the compromise was it's a two-volume set. It's actually it's heavy. It's the books themselves are 11 pounds. When you lift it up, you go, wow,
oh,
this is substantial. And the other thing that really struck us is the paper stock is beautiful. It's very nice. It looks very nice. We are very pleased.
It's going to be a great Christmas gift for so many people.
I know that sounds kind of silly, but when you pick it up
doesn't.
And thumb through it, it makes the book feel important, and it kind of invites you to thumb through it and just kind of lose yourself in the pages.
Exactly. So I'm looking at some of them. There's Picard as Robin Hood. That's so interesting. I mean, this is this book you can look through again and again and again, and you still miss stuff because there's so much. And there's actors on here you didn't even realize were in Star Trek. I mean, Christopher Plummer, who even knew he was in an episode of Star Trek?
Well, one of the things that people who buy the book tell us is, you think you're buying a reference book, and we hope it's a useful reference book, but people just, they say they'll watch Star Trek, and then they'll pull out the book, and then they'll look up something that they saw on the air, and then they'll find something else, and they'll find something else, and they'll find something else. So it's not just a reference, it really is a way to explore Star Trek.
And Star Trek is such a rich universe, and both Mike and I worked on several feature films and all incarnations except the original, which of course was in the 60s.
Right.
So we hope we bring to it also a sense of that that we were there. We treated the encyclopedia as a pure research project. We went back to the original scripts and corrected the episodes, the aired episodes, the scripts to the aired episodes. We also have memos and call sheets and so forth and so on. So this, it comes from a body of work because we were there working on the shows. And hopefully that makes it a more accurate and true reference novel.
Now, I take it you two are husband and wife, correct?
Yes.
Now, how long have you been collaborating together? How many years has it been? Is that not something I should ask? What's that?
He started as an official part of the Star Trek team with the movie Star Trek VI. She was a production assistant in the art department. And then our production designer, Herman Zimmerman, was so impressed with her that when we started up the next series, Deep Space Nine, he invited her to join as a graphic artist.
Oh, well.
Which I did, and I was also video supervisor. So Mike and I were, I think there were only like five of us on the production team that worked two shows at once, and we did that. We worked two shows at once and did a feature every other year. So yes, we spent more hours at Paramount Pictures instead of our home. If we didn't have dogs, we probably many times when we were up late, we threatened to bring our sleeping bags and take showers at the gym.
So you've been doing this over 20 years, obviously.
Long time, yes, long time.
And I mean, it's just an amazing. I mean, Star Trek's always been something I've been able to just enjoy. Every time I watch it, I enjoy it. I mean, and there's just something, you know, people have this idea that Trekkies are kind of weird people, you know, that we're different kind of strange people. But, you know, everybody, there's so many people that get into Star Trek. I don't even know the numbers, but I'm sure it's in the millions. But, I mean, we're no weirder than anybody else, are we?
Absolutely not. But the interesting thing is that Star Trek has such a broad appeal. And it's, that appeal reaches across the generations. It reaches across economics, socioeconomic, ethnic ranges, areas of interest. That it's really hard to draw a picture of a quote-unquote stereotypical Star Trek fan. We've met so many interesting people who like Star Trek. Doctors, engineers, computer programmers, astronauts. All were inspired by Star Trek. All were inspired by Gene Roddenberry's vision of a better tomorrow.
And especially today, when there seems to be a preponderance of people that want to look on the dark side and they want to exclude people and be a proponent of discord and hate, Gene Roddenberry's philosophy does not applaud that at all. He says that infinite diversity and infinite combinations, and that we all might be a little different, but together we're stronger and we should celebrate our differences. And boy, do we need that philosophy today in this world.
Amen. That is, there are no truer words than that. The way I see it, it's such a judgmental world out there right now, and we don't need any more of that. We just need people to get along. Everybody to get along, and that's asking a lot, obviously, but it's something that's necessary. And somehow, you know, the Star Trek fans always feel a kinship with each other. I mean, I know when I've been to some of the conventions that you feel like you belong in there. You feel like the people around you know who you are and what you're about, and they can identify with you.
They do, and again, they're all drawn together by their love of Gene Roddenberry's creation, but they're all so different. There are people of dramatically different political views, of different ethnic backgrounds and professions and ages, and they're all celebrating the notion that if we're smart, if we work together, if we employ science, if we're bold, if we're compassionate, that it can be a better world. And what better legacy for a television show?
What was it like day-to-day working on these movies? Was it really tough work, Mike? I mean, did it come pretty easy to you?
The working on a television show or a feature film is there's always intense pressure. There's always less time. There's always more demand. There's always always more things that you want to do than the schedule and budget will permit. And yet you're hired to say, okay, what's the best solution you can find? So if they need to create a new spaceship and there isn't time to build a new spaceship, what do you do? Well, maybe we take that from the previous episode and turn upside down, and then just build this new, or you know, whatever it is that you do. Every member of the production team is always trying to find creative solutions and trying to do it in a very short period of time.
I always like Majel Barrett's computer voice. Oh God, that was wonderful. She had such a great voice.
And of course now when Majel Barrett's computer voice first happened, it was pure science fiction. Whoever thought a computer could talk? And now we have that in our phones. We have that we have it in our computers, and we have it in our cars. And it's actually there. It's a Star Trek prediction that came to pass.
Now she's no longer with us, right? Majel, or is she?
No, she is not.
And neither is Gene, of course.
No.
Did you? What was the first time you were met? I assume you met Gene at some point or another.
Oh, many times. For one thing, he was the executive producer, and
right.
So we would meet him in a job capacity. But he was always very welcoming. In fact, there's the first book that Mike and I wrote as a team is called The Star Trek Chronology. And Gene actually asked us to write the book. He said, you know, there's so much going on now with the original series and now Next Generation. It's kind of hard to keep it on track together. Could you guys write a timeline? And therefore, we wrote the chronology.
And that's where the encyclopedia actually came from.
And that's where we did all this research and had amassed all this, all these data points. And that when the chronology was done, our publisher asked, would you guys be interested in doing an encyclopedia? And we said, oh, how hard can it be?
Right.
ignorance is bliss. So that's how the encyclopedia was born.
Now, I should tell everybody, this is published by HarperCollins. It's going to be out October 18th for anybody who wants to go get it. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people picking it up, like I said, for the Christmas holidays. But this, from what I understand, it was at least a two-year project. For this book alone, this version of it.
Yes.
Yeah, the last update of the Star Trek Encyclopedia was in 1999. And since then, there were, I don't know, there was nearly a full season of Deep Space Nine, 2.5 seasons of Star Trek Voyager, 4 entire seasons of Star Trek Enterprise, 3 Star Trek movies. And so the sheer volume of new material was tremendous. And it was literally a full-time job for us for close to 2 years.
I still remember when Next Generation went off the air and how disappointed I was. And I know it was an expensive show to produce, and that's from what I heard, that was part of the reason they couldn't do it much anymore. But, of course, then they went over to movies. But the TV show always has a place in my heart as being some of the best stuff, even though the movies were certainly had their own merits. I preferred the TV show. I don't know how you guys feel, but of course you were working on the movies. So.
No, well, we worked on both. So
yeah.
I think both of us absolutely have a preference for, I know working in television, we enjoyed it more. You get to be with the same group of people day after day after day. It's not that like that on a feature film. It's you're there for a couple months together, and then you disband and you move on to the next thing. But having worked on Star Trek for so many years, we basically work with the same people. And not only is that nice just because you know people, but because you adapt a nonverbal language. You trust each other. You know you got to get this done. You know you got to work with each other to get it done. And so we very much preferred television as a working model. But I also think as a viewer, I think television is so much more intimate. the characters are able to grow over a period
absolutely.
Of, well, back then it was 26 and then 22 episodes. Now, a lot of shows are 10, 13 episodes long, and that's it. Mm. So we like television. We as a viewer, we like it. And it, like I said, comes into your home, and you can kind of watch it at your leisure.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. And with a two-hour movie, you can't get into things as much as you want. I mean, and then you have to wait another 2 years for the next movie to come out. So it's kind of like with a TV episode, all you have to do is wait a week.
Yeah. Well, there's a trade-off on a movie. You have a much bigger budget, so you can do more interesting things. You have a longer shooting schedule, so you can shoot things you couldn't have shot. So each has its charms, but our hearts are with television.
Now, it looks to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that every episode is listed by the name of the episode in this. Is that every show in here?
Every single Star Trek episode, something like 700 and something episodes, plus all the movies. So, yes, that's a lot of typing.
Now, has it updated to the latest Star Trek movie?
No, that was still in production when we had to wrap the book up. Of course, you have to do that months in advance because it has to be laid out and printed and so forth. So Star Trek Beyond is not in this encyclopedia because it was still being made.
Right.
But we are proud that ours is the first major reference work to incorporate the two feature films that were directed by Abrams that brings in that alternate universe into the fold, so that adds another layer of complexity and information into the book.
And J.J. Abrams, every time I see him, he just looks like a kid in a candy store. You know, he just looks like he's having fun no matter what he's doing. I mean, he's producing all kinds of different things. I mean, he's getting his hand in all these different projects, and he just seems to have a blast.
That's our impression as well. We actually were Abrams fans a long time ago. He used to produce a show called Alias that we used to watch.
Oh, yeah.
In the art department, which is kind of a sci-fi spy show. So, of course, we've followed his career ever since then.
Absolutely. So how many different TV, besides Star Trek, have you guys worked on a lot of different TV shows, sci-fi shows, or otherwise?
Star Trek is by far the main thing. We've done little bits and pieces here and there on various other things. Most recently, I actually did, not for sci-fi, I did computer screen graphics for Clint Eastwood's movie Sully.
Oh, cool. That looks like I have yet to see that, but it looks interesting, very interesting. Looks very intense.
It was intense. It was fascinating because it was based on fact. There actually is a real aircraft. There actually is a real flight. So on Star Trek, you have the challenge of trying to invent something that looks plausible, but it's fun, but you can pretty much do what you want. Whereas here, there was an actual aircraft. There actually is an Airbus A320, and people know how you fly it. And more than that, the facts and figures and statistics of the flight have been widely published, so you have to match those things.
Exactly. Now, there is, even as we speak, I believe there's a new Star Trek in development, a new Star Trek TV show?
Yes, that's Star Trek Discovery. It's being produced by CBS All Access. Our former co-worker, Brian Fuller, is a showrunner on that. And that's being shot up in Toronto. And we're very much looking forward to seeing it.
All right. You won't be working on it, you guys?
No, it's a Canadian production. And we kind of like our home here.
Right.
No, it's in Toronto.
Which is a lovely city, but
it's not home.
Will it have any of the old characters from any of the old TV shows?
We don't have any idea, and that's kind of what we want. We're very much looking forward to watching this new show as viewers. We haven't been able to do that. When you work on a show, you know what happens.
Right.
And so we're very much looking forward to being a viewer and looking at it with fresh eyes.
Exactly. I'm trying to picture 11 pounds these books weigh. That's amazing. That's a huge book.
It's heavy.
Yeah, don't drop it in your feet.
Yeah, it's heavy.
I mean, I just can't imagine all the work you have done on it. I mean, and what a fascinating just a fascinating. I mean, I haven't seen the finished book, but I mean, just from looking at it online here, just the pages is it's just stunning. I mean, there's so many things in this book. Now, there's is every character in here too? Every character from every show?
Pretty much. There's over 700 episodes, so it's certainly possible we miss something, but we sure as heck tried not to.
Now, have you guys written books, like fiction books about Star Trek? I know there was a lot of Star Trek novels out there. They've kind of died off a little bit. I don't even know if they're even published anymore, are they?
No, there actually is a vibrant Star Trek novel program, and quite a few, but no, we haven't written a Star Trek novel.
So why not? Do you have any interest in doing that?
We were asked to do this, and we sort of feel like this is our contribution to the novels. We hope that this book will be a resource to our friends who write the novels, so that they can say, okay, here's something I can build on. Or, what did he say? I remember he went to school. Where did he go to school? So you can look that up.
Right. So the fiction part of it is not what you enjoy. You're more the technical aspect, I think, is what you're telling me, right?
Pretty much. I mean, these were, like I said, these are research, just like you would write a term paper or you would do a research project in college. That's how we treated the research books that we've done. It happens to be on a subject that is fun. It's Star Trek. That's what we've done. And we were writing the books while we were still working on the shows. I mean, this was our day job, was working in television, and on weekends and in the evenings we would write the books. So it's not the main thing we do. We enjoy it, but it's kind of a side thing.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's such memories with each show. I loved Deep Space Nine. I talked to people that, and everybody has their favorites. You know, and when they finally got off the space station on Deep Space Nine, it just became the most, even more of a fascinating show, I thought. And I mean, everything about that show I loved.
Each show has its charms, but we love the story arcs in Deep Space Nine. The discovery of the wormhole, the Dominion War, and each character grew in such interesting ways throughout the show. And that's kind of one of the things that we enjoyed when we wrote the book, the encyclopedia, that is we got to follow each of these characters, and we got to distill them down and to try to celebrate it. So we saw ourselves not as novelists, but we tried to be researchers or journalists. We kept saying to ourselves, how do you know that? And you'd go back and say, well, that's not exactly what he said. So you try to get it as accurate as you can. And to us, that's part of the fun of the book.
Plus, the fans are so detail-oriented. They remember everything. So you have to be on your toes with them, because I'm sure they find every mistake if you make any.
Absolutely. Star Trek fans are an incredibly discriminating audience. They're passionate about the subject. They know the stuff, and they expect you to live up to their expectations. So that's something we try to do.
I still remember. I don't remember which show she was going to. I think she was going to be Lindsay Wagner. Almost the captain on Voyager, and I would have loved to have seen that. And she never did become. It was Kate Mulgrew, but I still remember when they were casting that, and she was one of the possibilities. And I thought, oh man, because I always liked Lindsay Wagner. I thought she would make a really good captain.
Well, she was wonderful in the Bionic, and I agree that would have been fun. But ultimately, Kate Mulgrew turned out to be a wonderful choice. She had you believed that this woman was determined and she was going to bring her crew back from the edge of the galaxy, no matter what. And throughout that entire series, Kate Mulgrew just had the strength about her.
Oh, absolutely. And the voice. I mean, that voice was just so commanding. You know, you listened to what she said. You had to. I mean, he's being the captain. But the voice
right.
is so important. I mean, you think back to Captain Kirk's voice, and he really didn't have a commanding voice, I wouldn't say. I mean, it was more of a, a regular, everyday kind of guy voice, you know. But as the other captain, I mean, Picard's voice, of course, was amazing because he was a stage-trained actor, Patrick Stewart. I assume Kate Mulgrew was too, but, you know, and then you think of all the different ones and what they were like. And it's,
yeah, William Shatner was very much a professional actor. He was with, he went way back, and he was in the theater. It was a different time. It's the 60s. There was a different look. You know, so I think one of the things that is really, really interesting in Star Trek with all the different incarnations is that each one has and brings a different look. You know, Ben Sisko, Avery Brooks in Deep Space Nine was very different than Scott Bakula in Enterprise. So that's just one of the fun things about Star Trek.
Well, when working on the shows and the movies, did you... How was it with the different personalities? I don't know. How closely did you work with the actors, or was it more with the production team that you worked with?
We mostly work with the production team. Of course, we work with the actors, and you're right. They're all very different. Patrick Stewart likes to come off as this commanding Shakespearean person. But he also has this really sly sense of humor, and he was simply a delight to work with. We would I designed all of the control panels on the Enterprise, so whenever his character Captain Picard had to fly the ship, Patrick would always call me down to the stage and he'd say, "Okay, Mike, what button do I push to do this and this and this?" and the truth of the matter is, I could tell you in generalities what the things were. But, you know, did I figure out on a software level, here's how you do it? No. So I kept telling him, well, Patrick, it's more about the way you push it, the confidence and the panache with which you push it. And he goes, yeah, but which button do I push? So I'd say, that one.
That's funny. He sounds like he's a little impatient. He just wants to know, you know. I mean, it's bad enough they got to learn their lines, or they got to learn how to push buttons correctly, and all this other stuff. I guess it's a lot. It's a lot on their plate sometimes.
It's a lot on his plate, but he took his job very, very seriously, and he wanted to have a sense of reality, and he wanted to be in the character in the moment, and obviously he did a wonderful job of that.
I'm wondering about Diana Muldaur. She didn't seem to work out too well for the show, even though, you know, you watch the episodes, and she's a pretty strong character. But for some reason, didn't last very long. Would she last a season or two?
She was on Star Trek The Next Generation for one season. But actually, she was she played a couple of roles in the original Star Trek, which is why we were so excited to get her on Next Generation. She was in on a couple of really outstanding episodes of the original series, including something called Return to Tomorrow. So we knew of her, and it was just very cool to someone whose performance you enjoyed so much in the past to see her again.
I mean, I have a soft spot for Gates McFadden. There was something about her that I just loved. So I was very happy to have her back, I must admit. But I didn't have any objection to Diana Muldaur either. You can get used to these new characters, you know. Sometimes it's a little tougher than others, but I can't think of anybody that was really, really bad on any show, consistently bad. You know, everybody made fun of Wesley Crusher, but, you know, because he always figured it out. Here's this little kid figuring out everything, you know, and it's just, it was almost humorous. The way he could figure it out like that. But I mean, there's so many personalities on so many different shows but I can't think of one I really hated.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think the character of Wesley Crusher wasn't the best written, but it also captured the charm in Will Wheaton, who really is a smart and a really nice guy.
Mm-hmm. And his character changed as, you know, he came back in a couple of episodes, and as the character matured. I think it turned out well. And again, Will is a friend of ours, and he's a really nice and very smart guy. And but you know, it's an ensemble group too. I mean, all the incarnations of Star Trek. It's an ensemble group. And one thing in the Star Trek Encyclopedia, you will have an entry, for example, Picard, with a photo, and then it'll kind of be a chronology of what, you know, his life and what we experienced, and you'll be going down at the end of the entry, then there will be other things for you to look up. So you can kind of cross-reference if it says, you know, Picard fell in love on this planet. You can look up that planet and get more information about that planet. So I think when you watch an episode, if you want more information or more specific information, you can go to the book, and you can get that there.
So what is in this edition? I think you mentioned a couple things before, but what's totally in this edition that wasn't in the last edition?
Well, it's not... it's essentially a continuation of the previous editions of the Star Trek Encyclopedia, but there's just so much more information. Not only do we have hundreds of new episodes to cover, but in addition to that, there's each succeeding Star Trek series, the stories got more complex. Each succeeding movie, the stories got more complex. The characters got more complex. So the actual amount of information in, say, an episode of Voyager was more than we had in an episode of Next Generation. And by the time we got to Enterprise, there was actually quite a lot of information about the characters that were developed. And so we know so much more about these people than we did when we started the encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
So just tracking all that, trying to get new spaceships. One tiny thing that I'm actually very proud of is, I was the head of graphics for Star Trek for that entire period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I designed a lot of symbols and alien written languages. So I've got a collection of written languages and alien symbols and logos that grew quite a lot since the last edition. We even got quite a bit of material from the gentleman who was the graphic designer for the new Abrams film. So it's a fun several pages you look at it and you say, oh, there's the Klingons and there's the Romulans and there's whatever. Similarly, we've got these amazing spreads with all these new CG renderings of starships. You can look at the different spaceships. You can look at the different Starfleet uniforms. Again, it's designed as a reference work, but we think of it really as a way to have fun exploring the universe.
Right. I'm looking at LeVar Burton here. I know he was such an incredibly good actor for the show. I mean, it's amazing how they got these people who really fit in really nicely. I mean, you have a show, you really have to have the characters fit in nicely, or it can ruin the whole show if you have one character that just doesn't seem great, you know. Worf, I mean, Worf was so good, and just, they were all, I mean, everyone you can think of was just, had his own unique qualities, and fit in pretty nicely.
Well, Michael Dorn was a really interesting case, because his character really wasn't originally conceived as a major role in the show. He was, it was really just intended as someone on the bridge who was a Klingon to show, that was Gene Roddenberry's way of saying that people that who are enemies today aren't necessarily our enemies tomorrow. And once he was there, our writers found out this is a fascinating character, and they wanted to tell stories about him. And of course, Michael Dorn had this. It's such a wonderful performance. So it kind of snowballed. And by the time the end of Deep Space Nine, he was one of the richest, most complex, fascinating characters in Star Trek.
Yeah, that was a great thing they did, bringing him into Deep Space Nine. It really added a lot to it, and I think it really enhanced the show quite well. And really, you know, and you could tell off stage he was such a nice guy. I mean, every time you see him, he was smiling, so you knew he was. But to hear him get, you know, the anger he had as Worf was just amazing. I mean, just the just the way that, but I mean, you, like I said, the characters are just so, I mean, everyone has their own peculiar qualities about it, and it was amazing how you found out these different things about the characters. I was watching an episode of Voyager the other day, and all the different people are starting to disappear on the ship. It was just, it's just fascinating the way they did it, you know. And do you think the writing quality was good for every show, or do you think some were better than others in your mind?
Well, again, I know this sounds like a strange answer, but each show has its own peculiar strengths. Some of the shows took a while for the writers to find their footing. Next Generation didn't have the strongest start, but by the time they hit the third or fourth season, that was a fine show, I thought. So the answer is really it depends.
I mean, maybe you have your favorites and you're afraid to say what they are, but then that's fine. Everybody.
Oh, my favorite TNG episode is The Inner Light.
The Inner Light. Is that the one? Remind me what that one's about.
The Inner Light is one of the best episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. Captain Picard is zapped by an energy beam from some alien space probe, and he loses consciousness, and he has a dream, and in that dream, he spends an entire lifetime on an alien planet, and he discovers that planet is doomed, and he is now reliving the memories and the life experience of the last survivor of that planet.
Yeah, he lives with, I remember the woman he was living with, he you know, lives in this little house, and he's wearing these robes.
And at the end, he finds a flute from the planet, and that's the last artifact from that world, and he is the last person to remember that world.
Why do you think that's one of the better episodes? I mean, what about it is
so rich in character, such a wonderful story, such an amazing performance by Patrick Stewart. The music is powerful. The production design is beautiful. Cinematographer Marvin Rush brought that planet to life. He used lights to tell the story. You can go on and on. It was a wonderful.
Now, was that episode before or after he was taken over by the Borg?
I believe that was after.
After, yeah, because I remember one of the first shows after he came back from the Borg, I remember he just has a total breakdown. And that episode I always remember that episode in my head. It's one of my favorites. It's because he was so raw and so real, the way he just totally breaks down. And, mm-hmm. I mean, it just shows you how really talented Patrick Stewart really is. And the full range of emotions that he can show. And I mean, when he's angry, you know he's angry. When he's sad, you know he's sad. I mean, he just portrays it so well.
You know, you're absolutely right. Patrick Stewart was and is an amazing actor. He's a large part of the reason why Next Generation was such a success.
I wonder why. I mean, coming from as a stage-trained actor, you wonder why they do TV. I mean, a lot of stage-trained actors think that, you know, TV is like a come-down. Not anymore, but they used to. I mean, it used to be like, you know, I'm not doing TV. You know, it was like a come down from the stage or from the big screen. You know,
Patrick's a pro. He does his best no matter what it is.
An actor is an actor, and you see actors go from stage to TV. Some go to feature films, but in all the years that we've worked with, and they're coworkers. I mean, they're the actors. They're the stars of the show that are up front, but there are co-workers. They're people, just like us. Like you.
Do they ever become family to you, too?
Well, definition of family is very broad. Certainly, some people we got closer with, some people from the production, actors and behind the camera, we still stay in contact with. I mean, you work with people year after year after year, and projects and time will separate you. That's the normal pattern of life, but family, like I said, it's somebody you work with, you trust, and you enjoy their company, and you have things in common. So we were very, very fortunate to find a lot of new friends working on Star Trek.
I know you said you keep in contact with Will Wheaton. Do you have other people from the cast you regularly keep in contact with? From the cast?
Sure.
You do? That must be really cool.
Especially especially nowadays through social media, you literally exchange three words through on Twitter, but you know, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, but again, I think it's really important, and this goes back to Gene Roddenberry's philosophy. You know, we're all the same. Their job was to be an actor. Our job was to work in the art department.
Absolutely.
Each had a different role. Each had a different role in bringing the community together. So we've stayed in touch with some actors, and we've stayed in touch with a lot of behind-the-scenes people. It's just, you know, a commonality and interest that you may share. Bob Picardo, who played the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager, is a big proponent of the space program and very active,
very cool.
And so are we. So, of course, we have a lot in common with Bob. So it's just like life, just normal life in a job. We just happen to work on a really cool job.
Now, and it seemed like a lot of the cast of the different shows became directors, too. I noticed that, like, especially in, like, Voyager, a lot of the Voyager cast, I see their credits in other shows as directors. And I think that's really cool. I'm like, oh, wow. It just adds something cool to when you're watching the show to think, you know, that they directed it. And I really like that. I like that they can do all that other stuff. I mean, actors today, they do a show 4 or 5 years, and they become more actively involved with the show. Because they have such a common interest in it. I mean, it's something
that they... Our executive producer, Rick Berman, had a very progressive program. I don't think it started out as a formal program, but he allowed people who had the inclination and the talent to progress to actually direct not just cast members, but in some cases our writers, in some cases our one of our editors became a very fine director. One of our visual effects supervisors, a couple of our visual effects supervisors directed episodes, as did our cinematographers. So you have these people, the actors and these creative people, who really, as you say, have a deep creative insight into the show, able to bring their vision, and I think it helped their careers. It certainly helped the show.
I'm always amazed by an actor who can direct themselves, and I think, how do they do it? How do they direct themselves? You know, it's like they.
Yeah, I haven't a clue. That's got to be hard.
It's like, what do? You just tell yourself what to do. It seems so weird. Now, are you guys in this book? Are you guys listed in the book?
Well, we're on the title page.
But I mean, are you listed in the alphabetical listings? Is what I was getting at.
No.
No.
No. Actually, sort of. There's in the back of the book. There's an appendix of as many people as we could identify who were on screen, and there were a couple of episodes where we were tiny figures in the background, so we put ourselves there.
But the gestalt of the book is you are living in the future and you pick up this reference book just like we would pick up a reference book to, you know, World War II or whatever. And so the people making the show aren't going to be in the book. It's a book of the fictional characters, the fictional universe, treated as it was real. So you wouldn't see, you know, a director or a production designer listed in the body of the research.
Right, exactly. Did they often? You said they with directors. Did they often use the same directors, or did they welcome new directors? I mean, it must be.
Both.
I would think it would
both.
Be hard to get in as a director when you don't really know the whole show.
No, in a director, especially in television, they go to different series, and they may not know the show intimately, but they don't need to. If they go in and they do their homework, I mean, you certainly have to do
okay.
your homework.
All right, so it wasn't an issue then with new directors. I just wondered about that.
You know, I'm sure it was easier, as it would be if you're familiar with something, if you go in and you've done it more than once. And you know the actors. I mean, a first-time director coming in, they're meeting people for the first time. You have to establish a relationship, and they may not be as familiar with the show as other directors. But I think everybody tried to be kind, and if a director didn't understand, they would educate them. Certainly the actors knew their characters extremely well. They lived with them for, on average, 7 years.
Did you guys ever want to direct?
Me, no. Directing is a demanding, difficult art form. There are so many things you have to do. Would I ever want to do it? Maybe, but frankly, on this various Star Treks that I was working on, my job on the show as graphic supervisor was so demanding that I could not think of taking on another thing.
Right, exactly. But I just wonder whether you ever came in to work one day and thought, well, I wish I could direct an episode. If I didn't have all this other stuff to do, I wish I could just direct an episode.
Everyone says, yeah, I wish I could call the shots. But in order to have that, there's a saying, with great power comes great responsibility. You are responsible for all these resources, and you have to deliver films. So the pressure is on our directors is very intense, and the amount of work that they have to do to get themselves ready to do that is fierce. So I have tremendous respect for our directors.
What's great about this book is you remember a character name, you go and look up the character, and it's like you're reliving part of the episodes, and it's a wonderful thing. And even if you don't remember the character name, you can go through the book and see and look at the pictures and remember the character by the picture. And there's so much you can do that over and over and over again. And not always see everything. There's just so much to see. It's like watching an episode. You don't see everything at first, and then maybe you watch the second time, and you're like, I didn't notice that before.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because, first of all, that was part of our intent. That's part of our hope. And we actually have heard that from a fair number of people, that it's just fun to curl up with the book and explore Star Trek.
Now, I remember when I had the first encyclopedia, I don't know that I have it anymore, but I just remember looking through it over and over and over, and then when I watch a show, I could, I wonder if that's in the book, I wonder if that character's in the book. It's so much fun. I mean, it's like looking at Leonard Maltin's TV book, or the movie book. When you see a movie, you want to see what he thinks about the movie. You want to get his take on it. And it's that's what this is. Like, you can look up and see what exactly the history behind the character is, and there's so many characters. I mean, I don't even know thousands and thousands and thousands of characters. I don't even know how many total characters there are in the Star Trek universe. It just seems to be on and on and on and on and on. I mean, there's so much. I mean, I know that Robin Williams was a big Star Trek fan, and he was at one point going to be on an episode. I don't know if he ever did it. Did he ever do an episode?
No, there was an episode where I had heard they were talking to about bringing him on, but for whatever reason, scheduling or whatever, it didn't work out. The good news is the guy that they did cast was an actor named Matt Frewer. I don't know if you remember a television show called Max Headroom.
Oh yeah, of course.
So, but he ultimately played that role. So I was thrilled to get to work with Matt Frewer.
Yeah, I just saw him in something. I don't remember what it was. But I remember... what was that?
Timeless?
Yes.
He's in a new show called Timeless.
That's what I saw him in. I just saw that last week. Oh, that's where I saw him. Very cool. Yeah, he's been on different things, too. But you're right. I think that's what it was. He seems to... I guess he likes the science fiction kind of... I mean, sci-fi, you think of sci-fi today, there aren't a lot of really great sci-fi shows on the air today that I can think of. I mean, not Timeless definitely has a promise, but I can't think of a lot of sci-fi shows that are on the air at the moment. Are there?
There's a fair number. The science fiction, fantasy, superhero genre is that. Arguably
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and then. It depends on what you call science fiction, too. Honey.
That's true. Well, I'm thinking of more shows like Star Trek, and then more shows like Battlestar Galactica, and then Stargate, which I never really got into Stargate, but nor Battlestar Galactica. I do remember watching the original, but I mean shows like. But to me, Star Trek shows have a uniqueness about them. That it's like nothing I've ever watched before. It's like I'm in their own little universe, and that's what I love. You know, that's what I want to see more of, and I mean, I can't wait to see the new show. But I mean,
and that's absolutely part of the charm of the show, that is people who have invested so many days and hours watching the episodes of the movie. You feel like you're part of it, and each new episode, each new movie, each new book, you find you're rediscovering it.
And you never had to worry about sex or too much violence. There never was a lot of violence in Star Trek. It was never over the top violence. It was always violence in the course of the action. It made sense. You know, they never had gratuity. I mean, The Walking Dead, which I love, absolutely love, has a lot of gratuitous violence in my opinion. But I still love the show. But Star Trek never had that problem. They were always easy to watch. You don't have to worry about your kids.
It's generally been pretty family friendly. There have been a few moments.
Yeah, it's generally, you know, PG rated, and maybe even not PG, G or PG. But you know, you didn't have to worry about your kids what they were watching. Not like you have to today. It just seems like. But when I was first watching Next Generation, every Saturday night when I watched it, I just remember the joy I got out of sitting and watching that show. Every new episode was an adventure for me. And maybe that sounds a little corny. Probably doesn't to you guys, but it might sound corny to somebody. But the joy I got out of it is like nothing I'll ever experience again.
And what you've just said is really the reason why we all work so hard on the show, because even when the pressures get on television get intense, which they do, even when you're tired, you know that there's people out there to whom this is a special experience. And so thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and I mean, I still can remember every week just the joy I got out of it. And you put that joy in a jar, and you think, God, I wish I could just do that every show I watch on TV. I feel that way about Walking Dead too. But that's a totally different kind of a show. But I still feel that sense of, I can't wait to see the next one. I can't wait to see what's going to happen in the next episode. You know, and you're almost, and the disappointment you feel when you find out there's a repeat coming up or something. It's like, oh no, not a repeat, please. You know, you want those new episodes. And that, I mean, and you guys were part of that. You were part of my enjoyment, and for that I thank you. And it's been a wonderful,
well, thank you,
and continues to be a wonderful experience for me.
Well, thank you so much for saying that, because yeah, you're right. It was an extraordinary experience.
And to know that all your hard work pays off, and that there's millions of people that enjoy what you do, and will always enjoy what you do, has got to mean an awful lot to you guys.
It does indeed.
This has been great fun. You guys are terrific sports. Let me do this for an hour. I've enjoyed every moment of it. And the book is amazing. The Star Trek Encyclopedia Revised, out in your bookstores October 18th, published by HarperCollins. And 11 pounds, like he says, and worth every penny, I'm sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.